Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So this week, I witnessed something I have never witnessed before in all my rock history, Mark.
All my born days.
It took place on Friday lunchtime. I went to Ronnie Scott's in London, Soho, where there was a kind of reception and playback. Playback is always an expression, I don't know about you, that sends a chill down my spine.
Well, it sends a chill if the person who was responsible for making the record is in the room.
Because there you go.
It's so difficult to respond when you're hearing something for the first time, you know.
Anyway, it was a playback of the upcoming record by Elvis Costello. And I went. Had to produce my vaccination certificate at the door and all that kind of carry on. And, you know, went through quite a number of people there. And, well, quite a lot of people, actually, instead of industry people, as you'd expect. And then a bunch of kind of hardcore Elvis Costello fans, I think, were there. And the MC of proceedings was Matt Everett. He's very good at this kind of thing, and made enthusiastic noises about the new Elvis Costello album, and said, we're going to play five tracks. And you know what it's going to be like when you're going to have to listen to five tracks in the presence of a record company, and there's a room full of people. They're going to start off playing it really loud. And then
all the people from the record company sort of nodding furiously.
Yeah,
clicking fingers and
whatever it is. This is just the greatest thing I've ever heard in my life. As if they're ever going to convince anybody else of that. You know, people come to music in their own time, you know, anyway. And also what they'll do is, however loud the first track is, it won't be as loud as the second track, and neither will be as loud as the third track. Because what happens, as soon as they feel anybody's attention is wandering in any way, they turn it up louder. It's just one of those things. So after a while, it kind of distorts. You think, this is sort of oppressive noise. You know what I mean? Doesn't matter what it is. There's no reflection on the music. It's just the fake circumstances of listening to anything in those conditions. Anyway, they play the five tracks. And then he introduces Elvis Costello. He's going to come out and talk. And Elvis comes out. And I have to say, first of all, I was relieved in one aspect of his personal appearance. Now, I don't know where you stand on this, but I was very relieved that Elvis Costello was not wearing a hat, because I found his hat wearing slightly distracting. Do you feel the same way?
Yes.
Trying slightly too hard.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like him anymore. And also wearing hats indoors.
It just seems,
there's a reason to have it.
Yeah. Anyway, so I was very pleased to see that he came on without the hat. And he, you know, sat on a stool. And I think Matt Everett pretty much only got away one question. And, you know, we've all been in Matt Everett's shoes at those kind of things. You want people to talk. You don't want them to talk too much, or you don't want to get boring. You know, you want to move them on topic to topic. But anyway, He said, well, you must know this place pretty well, Ronnie Scott, you know. And Elvis just started. He said, and he just pointed at different tables. He said, yeah, I sat there to see Ray Brown in, you know, whenever it was, 1984 or whatever. I sat over there with so-and-so to see somebody else. And he just recounted.
That's really such a clever device, isn't it?
Such a clever.
It just nails your attention and makes you feel this happened right here. You're all looking around to see, wow, I imagine that.
And so you immediately relax because you think, I'm in the hands of a communicator. You know what I mean? And then he just continued. And he talked for the best part of 45 minutes.
Incredible.
And this is
with
what,
no notes, nothing
no
like that.
Notes, no notes, nothing at all. This is what makes it unique in my experience with rock stars. He talked 45 minutes. In a completely absorbing, free-ranging, colourful, funny, perceptive fashion. Didn't need any help at all. There was no hesitation. There was no deviation. There was no repetition, as they say on, was it just a minute? We say that, like, yeah. There was, I thought after a while, after about 10 minutes, I thought to myself, my God, he hasn't even said or There was none of those natural conversational hesitations. He just moved on from one thing to another. And I don't think it was particularly, I mean, some of it may have been stuff he said on stage before, I don't know. And some of it may be as a consequence of spending, you know, the best part of 2 years at home. So lots of stuff is stored up, you know. But he talked about how he'd last been in the UK, I think, in the days just before lockdown. They'd been on tour, hadn't they, in the UK?
Yeah.
He'd gone to Anfield to see Liverpool play Atletico Madrid. He'd begun to notice.
Which was the famous gig where they thought that coronavirus was imported from Italy.
Because from Spain.
That's right, sorry, yeah.
5,000 Atletico supporters, you know. And but he began to notice on that tour that sold-out houses weren't full and that some people weren't coming out. And when they played the final show at the Albert Hall, he joked about finishing with a song called Hurry on Doomsday, the bugs are taking over. You know what I mean? It was a kind of joke. Yeah. But then they'd all gone home, and it clearly wasn't a joke, you know, because they had to stay at home. And so everybody was quite happy at home for a couple of months. And then Pete Thomas got in touch with him and said that he drummed along. He drummed along to the entire Stax and Motown and Beatles catalogues.
Fantastic.
And decided nothing else was worth drumming along to.
What a wonderful thing to do, to get up in the morning and sit at your drums and bang on kind of Hard Day's Night.
Or reach out, I'll be there. Everything. Yeah. And so he'd done all that, and so it was kind of a little bit of a loose end. So they started recording, and they started recording remotely with Elvis doing songs and then sending them to Pete Thomas, Pete Thomas putting drum parts on them, and then sending them to the bass player and putting bass on, and then sending them to Stephen Bave, who then goes, there's no room here for me to put anything on, you know, because he talked about recording remotely. And how that was different. And he talked about the things that were good about it and the things that weren't. He then talked about, I mean, it's just stuff I can recall. He talked about his old teachers, his old school teachers in Hounslow. He talked about how the band got told off for not miming properly on Top of the Pops once. he talked about how the man who bought the image rights for Laurel and Hardy, I never knew any of this stuff at all. He talked about David Hockney painting with an iPad. He talks about what a thrill it is when you get your first TikTok hit. He talks about this album Spanish Model, which is this year's model done by a load of Spanish performers. And he talked about how he didn't want his next record to be just what he called another bucket of herring tossed into the stream, which was, you know, his way of referring to Spotify or the ways that music is disseminated. And he must have talked for about half an hour. He was incredibly colourful, incredibly illuminating. And I think Matt Ever at that point said, I think we have some questions from fans. And he read out one from somebody who was in the audience.
asking, a 25-minute response.
Asking Elvis how he felt to do the Royal Variety performance, because he'd done this apparently this week or something. And then he talked about how his father had done the Royal Variety performance. And then he talked about how it was 10 years since his father had died, and how in his last days he had to go and find him a room, a place at a care home for entertainers in West London, and how some of the rooms were named after people who had donated towards the care home, and how he really didn't want his father ending up in the Bernard Manning, Manning room.
A care home for entertainers.
Well, yeah, there's quite common. I mean, you'll find that, you know, there's homes for retired actors, variety artists.
What a lovely idea.
Well, there always has been, and, you know, because traditionally, and this stuff was very much started, you know, 100 years ago, wasn't it, lots of this, because musicians traditionally made no arrangements for their retirement whatsoever.
Yeah.
And very often were ill and so forth. So there's always been those kind of places. But, you know, in the end, he said, and what his message was at the end, he said he refused to dwell on the pandemic, and we've all got to get on with, got to be positive and get on with life, because we're all going to die. And then he pointed out a couple of people in the audience, and you're going to die. And you're going to and honestly, I've never heard anything like it. And, you know, and I've, you know, there are a handful of musicians who are good talkers, but they're not that kind of good talker. You know, Bruce Springsteen and people like that, they're very good talkers, but they're ramblers. Elvis Costello was not. He was like a teacher, you know, and he talked for 40 minutes. I mean, think of that. It's a lot. 40 minutes, I think, is the kind of, it's the magic duration for a thing of that nature. Because it's like a school lesson is 40 minutes, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And that's about the amount of time that the speaker can be expected to sustain it, and about the amount of time the audience can be expected to tolerate it.
Yeah.
You can't go any further than that. And he just had those kind of simple techniques of communication. And you just thought, this is absolutely unique.
It's exceptional.
And I tweeted about this, and I said how exceptional it was. People said, well, he's a wordsmith. Listen, there's loads of people who are wordsmiths.
Yeah, but they can't get them talking.
Can't do that. Can't get anywhere near doing that. That's not just command of words. That's communication.
But also, he notices everything. Do you remember that? Do you remember that piece in Vanity Fair in 2000 when he talked about the 500 best albums of all time? And the richness of his record collection, which contributes to why the music he makes himself is so colourful and varied. You know, talked about Cannonball Adderley and Beethoven and Salt and Pepper, Flying Burritos, Georgie Fame, the Heptones, Dan Hicks, in as much detail. I mean, extraordinary. I interviewed him, we've both interviewed him a few times, and his just ability to pinpoint things. I can remember asking him about what the greatest line, opening line in pop music was. And he said he had two. One was, is there anybody going to listen to my story all about the girl who came to stay? Which is good, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the other is, in the time of my confession, in the hour of my deepest need, from every grain of sand. And then he said that there are only five subjects that people broadly wrote songs about. And they were, I want someone, I lost someone, I believe in something, somebody died, and all I want for Christmas is a Duke of Prague away kid. Really kind of novelty. It was really clever. It's just his ability to kind of to assess precisely what's going on and talk about it in that kind of colourful, interesting way is phenomenal.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
And another thing about Elvis Costello, which has just struck me during the break, is it's so much about the energy of delivery. Because 99% of rock stars, when placed in front of an audience and expected to talk, will be exaggeratedly relaxed to cover their nervousness. They will be kind of incoherent. They will appear to be grasping for words and whatever. Whereas Elvis wasn't like that at all. He was completely towards you.
Yeah.
He was full of energy. He was welcoming. He was smiling. All those things that people just don't do.
But also a lot of them don't make the effort because they're assuming that they've got your attention already.
Yes.
Because they are who they are, which is completely wrong. You know, you've got to attack it, haven't you? You've got to go in there on the front foot.
Whereas he got on that stage at Ronnie Scott's because he really wanted to be there.
Yeah.
It wasn't a chore. He wanted to be there and he wanted to talk about his record and he just wanted to talk. And that's and as soon as people want to do that, the audience, whoever they are delighted.
Riveted.
Whereas, you know, if you sit there and kind of expect everybody to come to you, they won't come to you.
No.
Anyway. So the two of us went out earlier in the week, didn't we?
We did. Well, so it turned out that what we saw, I guess, was what we could call the world premiere, really, for the Get Back, the Peter Jackson Get Back movie. And we could call it that, couldn't we? I mean,
we
it was
could.
A screening, but I mean, you know, the turnout, the lots of the Beatles' extended family represented, Darny Harrison, Zach Starkey, Stella McCartney, Mary McCartney, Patty Boyd, and lots of and Glyn Johns and various Beatle-obsessed musicians. Elvis Costello again, wasn't he? He was there. Chrissie Hynde, Graham Coxon.
Oh, was Elvis there? I didn't see
Elvis. Elvis was there. Yes, he was. Right. Yeah, he was. And lots of Beatle fetishists, like people like us, actually.
Yeah,
and Professor Brian Cox and Martin Freeman and stuff. But it was a kind of one-off event, wasn't it, really? Because you can't show the entire six-hour movie, obviously.
It's more than six hours, isn't it?
So what we got was a 100-minute kind of edit, which included a filmed interview with Peter Jackson, introducing it and talking about, you know, how he'd come to make it, which was really, really interesting, wasn't it? The technical stuff
was
fantastically interesting.
Because it was classic case nowadays when it's such an indication of how things have changed, is that if you're doing anything nowadays, if you're making a movie, you simultaneously have to shoot the footage for the behind-the-scenes film of making the movie,
which will inevitably come.
And so one of the lovely touches in this was that you saw Jonathan Clyde of Apple taking Peter Jackson down into literally into the vault. I think it was Vault 3, wasn't it?
Vault 3 was on the door. That's right.
And you just opened this kind of, you know, heavy blast-proof door. And behind there with just these stacked cans of film, hundreds of them.
And what was the story of those tapes? I think there were 560 quarter-inch tapes. But a lot of them were stolen.
That's all. That's audio.
It's audio.
It's a complicated story, and I only know bits of it. I mean, there's however many hours of footage of a film, and then there's way more hours of audio because, you know, they had Nagra tape recorders, reel-to-reel tape recorders, such as they were used on documentaries back in those days. And that those will be running all the time, you know, so during rehearsals, during tea breaks, during anything, they were just constantly running. And so there's hundreds of hours of those. And loads of those disappeared, didn't they?
I think that they were stolen by somebody who worked at Apple and flogged to some music collector in Amsterdam or something. Was it? They only recently recovered in like 2005 or something.
Well, they got a call out the blue. I think this is what started this whole project, that Apple got a call out the blue saying somebody had got them.
Yeah.
And I don't believe they had to pay any ransom or anything like that.
I think they were just returning.
It's only when you... you know, you have the audio together with the film that you can start thinking about doing anything like Peter Jackson has subsequently done. So it was great to see that.
Also to see the bit where he talked about the technicalities. But he showed bits of footage of what it was like visually before they repaired it, because it was originally just the old 16mm blown up. And then they played bits of audio, didn't they, after they... And the difference was absolutely unbelievable, because the original Let It Be was very grainy, wasn't it? You saw it, in fact, in that very cinema.
I saw the cinema on that site. Yes, it was very grainy, because it was... I think we talked about this recently, that it was originally 16mm, and because it was going to be for telly. And then halfway through, they thought, no, it's not for telly, it's for cinema. Therefore, they blew it up. And you just lose a lot of definition when you do that. Whereas nowadays there is a technology to scan that stuff in a very different fashion, and so it looks very different. You know, what can we say about what we saw?
That was an amazingly creative period for the Beatles, wasn't it? If you think about it, my God.
Yes.
You know, their last had any time off at in 66, was it after Revolver? And they came
it's
back.
Just
and
run, did, it's just running through
run,
this.
Run through it. Yeah, it was a
So, let's go back. They stopped touring in 1966, don't they? So yep. They stop at Candlestick Park in San Francisco, which must be late summer 66.
It was.
Late summer 66. So they come back. They must have had some kind of holiday or whatever. But anyway, they start in the studio, late 66, working towards the stuff that will be Sgt. Pepper. Yes?
Yep.
And so
Penny Lane's
Strawberry Fields comes out in February. Okay. And then they carry on. Sgt. Pepper comes out in June.
Straight
right?
into Magical Mystery Tour.
Straight comes out. Now, hang on a second. No, hold on. In June, comes out in June. By which time they probably met the Maharishi. Yes. Yep. They go to Bangor to meditate Epstein with the Maharishi. Died. Brian Epstein dies. They then go and make Magical Mystery Tour. They have the idea of and go and make and put out on Boxing Day that year, Magical Mystery Tour.
A film and a WP.
Yes. And then...
Straight to India, pretty much.
Straight to India.
Where they write pretty much the whole of the White Album.
They come back and make demos at George's house, don't they? And if you... hear those demos, it's extraordinary to hear how much of it was just in place at that point. Yeah. And then they, you know, they go and make the White Album. John goes off to his... Does John have his accident then in 1968? Or no, he has since 69?
He has it when they're recording, 69, when they're recording... Abbey Road, I think. But anyway, they record all that. And
the White Album comes out, goes to number one, and the White Album is still at number one. On the 3rd of January 1969, when they convene in Twickenham Film Studios to start making.
Again, the intense creative kind of fervor is astonishing because they got no songs. They wrote in that, was it 3 or 4 weeks? They wrote 14 songs for Let It Be. We hear them. We saw little extracts from what we saw the other night of them playing Octopus's Garden, Oh Darling, Maxwell Silver Hammer, Something, Her Majesty. Child of Nature, which became Jealous Guy, isn't it? Give Me Some Truth.
Yeah.
I mean, stuff that finished up on the solo albums. Half of Abbey Road, all of that is written in that period, which is fantastic, isn't
it? Yeah.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I think I told you, I talked to Giles Martin about this, and he said, you know, his dad always used to say, the amazing thing about the Beatles is they kept it going for so long. Not that they didn't keep going any longer.
Yeah.
Because the quality of what they did was completely, it was bound up with the pace at which they did things. You know, if they'd had 2 years to think about it, they wouldn't have done it in the same way. You know, it's the speed of it.
Speed and the sense of competition.
Yeah.
And also the feeling you get watching that a lot of that footage was it's the fact it's the four of them together in the same room, which is the most valuable thing. They're constantly looking for the other's contributions to the way these songs can be arranged. When you hear the original versions of them and then compare them with the thing that they eventually released, you know, the complexity and the arrangements, the way they've changed it is absolutely phenomenal, I think. And isn't it interesting also that, you know, there's no footage of any groups really around that, a very little footage. And here we are, the greatest group, producing some of their greatest material, filmed 52 years ago, shot for hours and hours and hours, for days on end, with five different cameras. Absolutely astonishing.
We quite liked it.
We did.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Any other business? We are joined. He's back on dry land, ladies and gentlemen. Alex Gold. Home is the sailor, home from the sea.
Yes.
After 3 months
after being 3 months on the ocean wave.
Our mop top Matalow returns.
I'm putting that on my email signature.
I love the idea, Magic, that you were there for 3 months dressing up as John Lennon most nights and performing, and then flew back yesterday and went straight into a gig as Ian McLagan of the Small Faces at the Half Moon in Putney.
Yeah, it was a bit confusing, actually. I had to stop myself from doing the John Bob when I was playing. I'm just introducing into bobbing.
Yes.
Made it. It was a heck of a day. I survived and I'm still here, and there are no more gigs for me for the rest of the year. I'm taking the rest of the year off, which is something I've never been able to say before. So I'm quite happy with that.
Good for you. Brilliant.
So, questions from the massive or observations, agenda items. Gary Warren suggested he'd been listening to Dire Straits making movies, and he decided the whole of the first side was wonderful and the rest of it was just not worth listening to at all.
Which is true of quite a lot of records, isn't it?
And, led to a heated debate about records. About
a free and frank exchange of views.
You could say the same thing. And so I asked, you know, other people to chip in. Actually, Danny Baker, to Tarkus by Emerson Lake and Palmer. With which I'm not particularly familiar.
I'm not familiar enough to know,
it's apparently the same thing. Robert Knight says Combat Rock by The Clash. Is that the case?
Combat
Rock. It'd be Rock the Casbah and so forth.
Tommy Gunn and stuff like that.
Should I Stay or Should I Go is on Rock. On Combat Rock and all that. You know, Phil Kinderman says, how many people listen to... he was talking about Metal by Pink Floyd. He was saying the other way around.
The other way around. One of these days, though, the opening track on the first side, fantastic.
Right. Jim Slade says, side one of television's Marquee Moon, and then you can stop after there. Is that the case?
I think that's probably fair. But then again, there are various records that just as a whole concept seem to work, don't they? It's like someone was saying... Moon Dance, there was only the first half standing, which is a amazing record. You have to listen to the whole thing from start to finish. But also, no, because you've got Come Running and These Dreams of You on the second side. I tell you one good example, good example of an absolutely amazingly front-loaded record, which is Live Piece in Toronto by the Plastic Ono Band. First side is Blue Suede Shoes, Money, Dizzy Miss Lizzy, Your Blues, Come to Me, Give Peace a Chance. The B side is... two extracts of Yoko Ono, how can I put it kindly, kind of caterwauling, improvisational screaming. One is a track called John John, which lasts 12 minutes. So I imagine the second side of that hasn't been played very much. Pretzel Logic, Ricky Don't Lose That Number, Night by Night, Any Major Dude, Barrytown, East St. Louis, Toodaloo. That's
It's fantastic side, but all right, what's on the second side? Through With Buzz.
Monkey In Your Soul. It's not as good.
It's not as good.
I'll tell you a really good example of one that is very front-loaded, actually, which is Let's Dance by Bowie. Because you've got China Girl, Let's Dance Without You.
And then the rest.
Ricochet, Criminal World, isn't it? Cat People. You know, it's just that tails off badly.
See, but if you're making an LP record, presumably... if you come up with one hit, you know, it's something that sounds really good, you think we're on our way. If you come up with two, you think we're more than on our way.
Yeah.
If you come up with three, you think we've finished.
Yeah. You
know, any old rubbish.
Bring on the filler.
Bring on the bass player's track.
The police's method, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, you can put absolutely anything there as long as you've got those main props to hold up the tent. And as it got even more like this in the days of CD, didn't it? Because she didn't have sides.
Yeah.
And so the hits tended to be, moved towards the front of the thing, because the record company had a part in the sequencing and so forth. Although there are odd exceptions, although it's not quite the CD era. We have talked about this before, that Don't You Want Me by the Human League is the final track on Dare. And it was the hit.
Yeah.
And it was final track because Phil Oakey didn't want it on the record.
He didn't want it on the record, didn't really rate it, and didn't think it was going to be commercial. So astonishing.
It's absolutely.
But various other Joshua Tree, another good example. That's all front loaded, isn't it?
And that was famously sequenced by Kirsty MacColl, wasn't it? Who did it on the basis she chose the track she liked best first, the next best second, the next best third, and so forth. So if you're on the last bit of the Joshua Tree, she didn't approve of you too hard. you're not the big finish. You're just filler, So what was the other thing that the other hot topic was? This Danny Baker, wasn't it? That people who had a really good first album.
Oh, with a terrible follow-up. Yeah.
Terrible follow-up.
Oh, lots of obvious ones there. The Stone Roses and Frankie Goes to Hollywood, hardly worth mentioning. Terence Trent D'Arby, do you remember that? I remember that when I was at Q. He was the hottest ticket in town.
And then he wasn't.
Oh, my Lord. Introducing the Hardline, according to Terence Trent D'Arby. And then he put out a record called Neither Fish Nor Flesh. Which was, A is the worst album title imaginable, and B was simply frightful, ended his career.
I tell you, it's a really funny one, and it's an earlier one, and it's very different. The first Rolling Stones album is brilliant, and it's all cover versions of rhythm and blues classics. The second Rolling Stones album is cover versions of R&B classics, done by entirely the same band, entirely the same producer, entirely the same way. It's rubbish.
Oh, it's, you see, Roy, it's got
the second
Come Catch Me off the hook. Is that on there?
I wouldn't have thought so. I don't think Stone Off the Hook. Off the Hook came out as a B-side in the UK.
Oh, right, okay.
It's got Everybody Needs Somebody to Love and so
on. Yeah.
And Susie Q, I think, is on there. And Down Home Girl. There's the odd decent track, but it just shows how some records have just got magic and other records haven't, and they can be done by entirely the same people.
One really good example.
Alex.
Controversial to suggest that the second Beatles album, by comparison to Please Please Me, is a bit rubbish.
No!
Oh, no! Second Beatles album? You've been with
me? No! Alex, where are you staying?
It's going to be better than their first album.
I'm going to come around there and punch you.
That's just absolutely genius.
With the Beatles, it's way better record than Please Please Me.
All the cover versions are it. It's got Twist and Shout on it, hasn't it? No. It
won't be long. It's got Roll Over Beethoven. Yeah. It's got Please Mr. Postman. You Really Got a Hold on Me. Money.
It's fantastic.
It's got Hold Me Tight. It's all My Loving.
This is Beatles for Sale, right?
No.
I got my chronology wrong.
Beatles for Sale is the fourth least album. Good record. Yeah. That's the one with all the covers on it.
Right, let's go through this, Alex. First one's Please Please Me.
Yeah.
Second one's with the Beatles.
Yeah.
Third one's Hard Day's Night. Fourth one is Beatles for Sale. Is that right, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely right.
No, it's not. Is it? Really?
It is.
Now, I know you
heard it here first on this podcast.
I know you youngsters think the Beatles are yours, but, Mark and I still have some say in this on account of us having been there.
No, don't get me wrong. I'm just I'm kind of disappointed in myself having been inside the Beatles for 3 months and...
I'll give you a few more. Tracy Chapman. Chapman's first album, which is the brilliant one with talking about Revolution and Fast Car on it. Second album, I don't think anyone can remember a single track on it.
It's called Crossroads, isn't it?
Was it called Crossroads? Yes, it was. Crossroads. Well remembered. It's called Crossroads.
The Spokes.
After New Boots and Panties was Do It Yourself.
Which I like.
A couple of good tracks. It's got.
I like it.
And This Is What We Find.
This is what we find.
That which is a good song, but otherwise, nowhere near as good.
Well, I don't know. It's not as good. It did, I mean, but UB's Maddie's is a completely unique record.
Incredible record.
And therefore, you couldn't retain that impact again, could you?
Yeah.
Couldn't be done. But I really like Do It Yourself.
An absolutely corking example, I think, is Lexicon of Love by ABC was followed by Beauty Stab.
Yeah.
And it really went quiet at that point, didn't it? Because, you know, I mean, how could you follow Lexicon of Love? Fantastic.
Yeah.
In every respect.
Yeah.
So, and Magic might also back me up on here. I can't really remember it, but I think the second Arctic Monkeys wasn't that thrilling, whereas the first one was.
No, it wasn't. The first one was amazing. The second was kind of more of the same, but just not as good. Same with The Strokes. The first album was astonishing and it had all of the hype behind it, and the second one couldn't possibly live up to what people would have wanted it to be. So, the curse of the indie second album.
Okay, any other business? Anything else we've got to talk about? If you'd like to be a Patreon supporter, we wouldn't turn you away, would we? and if you want to find out more about how to be a Patreon supporter, go to patreon.com/word in your ear. Is that right, Alex?
Indeed, correct.
If you're a Patreon supporter at a certain level, you might even get the dubious pleasure of Mark Ellen and I shinning down your digital drain pipe
to rifle through your record collection
to mark your birthday by going through your record collection. We've had some good ones recently, haven't we? Some very, very,
really,
very
really
entertaining.
Fantastic.
Very entertaining contributions.
With amazing records.
I know what else I was going to talk about this week, actually. And the snobbery of people who work in record shops.
Sure.
Which I'm a bit of an expert in because, you know, I've been one of those snobs.
Yep.
You know. And I don't know if you can see this record. When you and I went round to Brent Hansen's a few weeks ago, and he was testing his new hi-fi, which costs more than your house, with an Ornette Coleman record called The Shape of Jazz to Come. And I thought I must get that, and so I went in to a jazz shop in Charing Cross Road, a little jazz shop within Voyles. Sorry, I've rather given away this guy.
We'll be able to track him down now.
I'm sorry. No, I'm not going to give him a hard time. But
what day does he work on?
What's he look like? Yeah, go on.
So he's more record shop. There's only one guy. And I'd been in there, and there was nobody in there, and I was trying to find Ornette Coleman there, and they got sections, you know, there's Miles Davis, there's Charlie Parker, and all the jazz there, and I'm going through, I can't see an Ornette Coleman section, there's a C section, but he's not in there, I'm not looking. I kind of pride myself how you worked in record shops, and having spent half my life in record shops, I can find most things in record shops, you know. And so eventually he turned up, the guy was at the counter. And I went towards him, and I always say the same thing. It's no doubt me being stupid, but I can't see where your Ornette Coleman CDs are. And he looked at me, and before he spoke, there was that flicker in his eyes that you get from record store staff when they're just asserting their marginal superiority over you, and they didn't even have to say anything. It's just in their eyes. He says, look at me, and the eyes were saying, isn't this bloody obvious?
Yeah.
But the mouth was saying, it's in the avant-garde section. This is quite a small...
I was going to say, it's filed under C. Have you tried looking? No, it's avant-garde. Okay.
This is... it's not a big record shop. It's not... Is it rough Trade East or the old HMV?
How am I to know that it's going to be an avant-garde?
Well, and also, Mark, I'm going to go further with this. If you're running a jazz shop, you would like to sell loads of jazz records. You'd like to sell Ornette Coleman records. Do you think... In what world, in what planet Do you increase the appeal of Ornette Coleman records by placing them in section avant-garde. Called avant-garde? It doesn't work at all. You know, and that is simply an example of the snobbery of music fans. And you'll find it the same if you go to Rough Trading.
Oh, actually. Yeah, making anything it's more not, esoteric it's not, and more, it, absolutely. More rarefied than it is.
It's German metal indie, or it's, you yeah. know, it's surf punk, or it's, I don't know what. You're not making anything more popular by doing that.
No.
You're decreasing the chances of anybody finding the way towards it or appreciating that. Because, you know, for most people, and I'm a bit like most people, to buy a jazz record, I've kind of got to feel a little bit brave. Just you do. If somebody then tells you,
well, you're feeling very exposed in a jazz shop, aren't you? Because you know that everyone's going to have far more knowledge than you are.
Well, it's a bit of that. Although I'm not stupid, and but you feel that way in the jazz section. If somebody says no over there in the avant-garde section, you turn around. And what you expect to see is kind of snow blowing across and leaves. Yeah. You know what I mean? And you expect to hear the distant howl of wind and probably wolves go, "Ooh! Oh, come over here. There's no joy to be had the over tundra. Here.
Yeah.
Isn't it really?
It is.
I think the abundance of genres is a problem as well, you know. Back in my day, it was really simple. It was rock, pop, and dance. That was basically soundtracks. That was basically it. Now there's sort of Spatula Core and Boggle, and you know, you know what to do with it. You know, I don't know really where I stand anymore with music.
Spatula Core was it? Spatula Core. That's great.
And honestly, I've been thinking about that ever since. And this guy, it was just a flicker of his eyes, But it was just registering the fact that I'm a little bit above you. And that's what guys behind record shop counters do. And it used to be at its worst. And I don't know if these places still exist. They probably do. Dance music shops in Soho. You know, those kind of specialist places.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they always, did you notice what it was like when you ever, yeah, you probably never went in one of those places. But behind the counter, they were obviously standing on a platform, literally standing on a platform.
In order to look down on you?
In order to literally look down on you. And it was, they were like a DJ booth. I'm in charge here.
We've referenced him a million times on these podcasts, but Jack Black, isn't it, in High Fidelity? The Jack Black character in the shop is just so perfectly cast.
Well, it's something.
When he says he doesn't want to sell the Captain Beefheart bootleg, and the guy comes in and says he wants to buy a copy of a Lionel Richie record for his daughter, he says, "Is she in a coma?" He's unbelievably rude.
No, but they don't go. I mean, I never worked with anybody who went that far. But you know, we did have a very patronising view of the public, and the most convincing bit in High Fidelity, because it always strikes me none of the people there have actually worked in a record shop.
Is when they sell the record by putting it on.
No, he says, "I will now sell 3 copies of the Beat the Band," and he's absolutely right. And
people can't say this is great.
We used to know we could do that all the time.
What sort of things did you sell?
You could, if you played the first Montrose album.
All right.
You always sold 4 copies. Always, because people had never heard it, and it was a kind of record that immediately people thought, "What is this?"
Yeah, yeah.
And yet he appealed to a load of people who'd come in to buy a Led Zeppelin record and thought, oh, God, no, I'm going to have this instead. You know, I can't remember off the top of my head the other things, but just things that had an immediate impact. Beta Band, I'm sure.
Yeah,
that's that was before, yeah. After my time in a record shop. But that's an equivalent, undoubtedly. And you probably wouldn't have heard it any other way than hearing it in a record shop. So, sorry, that's my little anecdote.
Good. I like it.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.